So if you think of a map of your country, I think you'll realize that for every country on earth, you could draw little circles to say these are places where good teachers won't go. On top of that, those are the places from where trouble comes. So we have an ironic problem. Good teachers don't want to go to just those places where they're needed the most. I started in 1999 to try and address this problem with an experiment, which was a very simple experiment in New Delhi. I basically embedded a computer into a wall of a slum in New Delhi. The children barely went to school. They didn't know any English. They'd never seen a computer before, and they didn't know what the internet was. I connected high-speed internet to it. It's about 3 feet off the ground. Turned it on and left it there. After this, we noticed a couple of interesting things which you'll see. But I repeated this all over India and then through a large part of the world and noticed that children will learn to do what they want to learn to do. This is the first experiment that we did. 8-year-old boy on your right teaching his student, a 6-year-old girl, and he was teaching her how to browse. This boy here in the middle of central India, this is in a Rajasthan village where the children recorded their own music and then played it back to each other. And in the process, they enjoyed themselves thoroughly. They did all of this in 4 hours after seeing the computer for the first time. In another South Indian village, these boys here had assembled a video camera and were trying to take the photograph of a bumblebee. They had downloaded it from Disney.com or one of these websites 14 days after putting the computer in their village. So at the end of it, we concluded that groups of children can learn to use computers and the internet on their own, irrespective of who or where they were. At that point, I became a little more ambitious and decided to see what else could children do with a computer. We started off with an experiment in Hyderabad, India, where I gave a group of children, they spoke English with a very strong Telugu accent, I gave them a computer with a speech-to-text interface, which you now get free with Windows, and asked them to speak into it. So when they spoke into it, the computer typed out gibberish. So they said, well, it doesn't understand anything of what we are saying. So I said, yeah, I'll leave it here for 2 months. Make yourself understood to the computer. So the children said, how do we do that? And I said, well, I don't know, actually. And I and I left. Two months later, and this is now documented in the Information Technology for International Development Journal, their accents had changed and were remarkably close to the neutral British accent in which I had trained the speech-to-text synthesizer. In other words, they were all speaking like James Tooley. So you can, they could do that on their own. After that, I started to experiment with various other things that they might learn to do on their own. I got an interesting phone call once from Colombo, from the late Arthur C. Clarke, who said, I want to see what's going on. And he couldn't travel, so I went over there. He said two interesting things. A teacher that can be replaced by a machine should be. The second thing he said was that if children have interest, then education happens.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett, and welcome back to the Purdcast. Today is November 3rd, 2012, and what you've heard in the show so far is an excerpt from a TED Talk given by Sugata Mitra, an educational scientist. I'll put a link to that entire presentation. It's about 17 minutes in the show notes for today's episode. Before we go any further, I want to say thank you to a listener named John for his participation in today's presentation, and he is participating in it in several ways. He sent me that TED Talk along with an article about Ethiopian children. And he said that the two complement each other very nicely, and I agree. In fact, I'm going to be reading the article on the show today. He also called into the after show portion of our live show on Thursday to elaborate, to discuss why he found this so important and how this could be useful information for new teachers, potential teachers, or anybody who is ready to rethink their conception of that word education, something that we are always encouraging people to do on this show. So I wanted to share this piece. It's from device.com, D-V-I-C-E.com. It's called Ethiopian Kids Hack OLPCs in 5 months with Zero Instruction. What is an OLPC? Well, those are computers that are given to young people in places like Ethiopia through the One Laptop Per Child OLPC project. What happens when you give 1,000 Motorola Zoom tablet PCs to Ethiopian kids who have never seen a printed word? Within 5 months, they'll start teaching themselves English while circumventing the security on your OS to customize settings and activate disabled hardware. Whoa. It says whoa in the article. I didn't add that. The One Laptop Per Child project started as a way of delivering technology and resources to schools in countries with little or no education infrastructure, using inexpensive computers to improve traditional curricula. What the OLPC project has realized over the last 5 or 6 years, though, is that teaching kids stuff is really not that valuable. Yes, knowing all of your state capitals and how to spell neighborhood properly and whatnot isn't a bad thing, but memorizing facts and procedures isn't going to inspire kids to go out and learn by teaching themselves, which is the key to a good education. Instead, OLPC is trying to figure out a way to teach kids to learn, which is what this experiment is all about. Rather than give out laptops to kids in schools with teachers, the OLPC project decided to try something completely different. It delivered some boxes of tablets to 2 villages in Ethiopia, taped shut, with no instructions whatsoever. Just like, hey kids, here's this box, you can open it if you want, see ya. Just to give you a sense of what these villages in Ethiopia are like, the kids, and most of the adults there, have never seen a word. No books, no newspapers, no street signs, no labels on packaged foods or goods. Nothing. And these villages aren't unique in that respect. There are many of them in Africa where the literacy rate is close to zero. So you might think that if you're going to give out fancy tablet computers, it would be helpful to have someone along to show these people how to use them, right? But that's not what OLPC did. They just left the boxes there, sealed up, containing one tablet for every kid in each of the villages, nearly 1,000 tablets in total, preloaded with a custom English language operating system and SD cards with tracking software on them to record how the tablets were used. Here's how it went down, as related by the OLPC founder Nicholas Negroponte at MIT Technology Review's MTech conference last week. Quote, "We left the boxes in the village, closed, tape shut. No instruction, no human being. I thought the kids will play with the boxes." Within 4 minutes, one kid not only opened the box, but found the on-off switch. He'd never seen an on-off switch. He powered it up. Within 5 days, they were using 47 apps per child per day. Within 2 weeks, they were singing ABC songs in English in the village. And within 5 months, they had hacked Android. Some idiot in our organization or in the media lab had disabled the camera. They figured out it had a camera, and they hacked Android. Unquote. This experiment began earlier this year, and what OLPC really want to see is whether these kids can learn to read and write in English. Around the world, there are something like 100 million kids who don't even make it to first grade, simply because there are not only no schools, but very few literate adults. And if it turns out, for the cost of a tablet, all of these kids can simply teach themselves, it has huge implications for education. And it goes beyond the kids, too, since previous OLPC studies have shown that kids will use their computers to teach their parents to read and write as well, which is incredibly amazing and awesome. If this all reminds you of a certain science fiction book written by a certain well-known author, it's not a coincidence. Nels Primer in Nell Stephens's The Diamond Age was a direct inspiration for much of OLPC teaching software, which itself is named Nell. Here's an example of how Nell uses an evolving personalized narrative to help kids learn to learn without beating them over the head with standardized lessons and traditional teaching methods. Miles from the nearest school, a young Ethiopian girl named Rahel turns on her new tablet computer. The solar-powered machine speaks to her. "Hello, would you like to hear a story?" She nods and listens to a story about a princess. Later, when the girl has learned a little more, she will tell the machine that the princess is named Rahel, like she, and that she likes to wear blue. But for now, the green book draws pictures of the unnamed princess and asks her to trace the shapes on the screen. R is for run. Can you trace the R? As she traces the R, it comes to life and gallops across the screen. Run starts with R. Roger, the R, runs across the red rug. Roger has a dog named Rover. Rover barks, roof, roof. The princess asks, "Can you find something red?" And Rahel uses the camera to photograph a berry on a nearby bush. "Good work. I see a little red here. Can you find something big and red?" As Rahel grows, the book asks her not just to trace the letters, but whole words. The book's responses are written on the screen as it speaks them. And eventually, she doesn't need to leave the sound on all the time. Soon, Rahel can write complete sentences in her special book, and sometimes the princess will respond to them. News stories teach her about music, and parenthetically here, she unlocks a dungeon door by playing certain tunes and programming with blocks. Parenthetically again, Princess Rahel helps a not very bright turtle to draw different shapes. Rahel writes her own stories about the princess, which she shares with her friends. The book tells her that she's very good at music, and her lessons begin to encourage her to invent silly songs about what she's learning. An older Rahel learns that the block language she used to talk with the turtle is also used to write all the software running inside her special book. Rahel uses the blocks to write a new sort of rhythm game. Her younger brother has just received his own green book, and Rahel writes him a story, which uses her rhythm game to help him learn to count. The end. And if you want to learn more about this Nell software, I'm going to include a PDF called Growing Up with Nell, a Narrative Interface for Literacy, in the show notes for this episode as well. You can check it out. Now, I want to be clear that this podcast is not intended to be any kind of endorsement for OLPC. I really don't know too much about it, but I know there has been some criticism of the program. Believe it or not, a lot of it has to do with IP issues. But another common criticism of OLPC is that there's no training. There's no guidance from the top down, you know, very old way of thinking about education. You can't just drop this technology off in places like Ethiopia, or as Mitra talked about in that opening clip, in India, and expect these third world kids to figure out how to use it. But that way of thinking is the polar opposite of the point that we are trying to make in the show today. And it's the opposite of the point that Negroponte says the whole program is trying to make. Nicholas Negroponte, the founder of OLPC. If I didn't mention his name yet, I think I did. Where, yeah, we want to see what kids can do outside of that top-down model. And he calls it constructivist, right? Now, that's a word that we've used on the show before, and we've been critical of constructivism. I believe we talked about this in a little bit of detail in a show called Outcome-Based Education, Behaviorism in Disguise. Constructivism was a term really used euphemistically as an alternative to knowledge-based education, the idea that there is objective truth and people can just make up what they want to believe, right? That your mind is not trustworthy to know the facts of reality, so go ahead and get fanciful with it. I guess that makes constructivism kind of a nebulous term, but it's often used for child-centered education, which I think is fine and does not necessarily preclude the idea of objective reality, even though the way that it's shown up in the schools, this is something that probably became popular in the 60s and early 70s, was to move away from actual objective knowledge. Surprise, surprise. And you can also learn more about this topic in a recent episode of School Sucks podcast called Logic Saves Lives, number 5, The Stolen Concept. So I wanted to include our discussion from the Thursday after show when John called in to share his thoughts on this article, and the conversation expanded from there. It runs about 35 minutes. I did a little bit of editing. I cut the beginning out because we started talking about a different subject. This is the portion that was relevant to the topic for the show today.
There was this experiment done in Africa where a huge group of children in Ethiopia were given tablet computers, basically. And they're put into a box, and you know, the kids were given the box, and they were going to be able to see what they could do. So it was kind of an experiment in natural learning. And so here's what happened. The children figured out within the day how to open the box. I mean, obviously, they would figure out how to open the box. They pulled out the tablet. They turned it on. Within 2 days, they had 47 apps, educational apps, going on the tablet. And within 2 weeks, they started teaching themselves English. Within 5 months, they hacked the Android system and completely took over the tablet, made it their own. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah. Can you imagine? So like the experiment, was foiled by human ingenuity, which that was what they were trying to measure.
So these kids were so ingenious that they broke the experiment meant to measure their ingenuity.
Exactly.
Good for them. I like these kids.
It's an absolutely amazing example of what the human mind is capable of. And it, for me as a teacher, you know, I got the feeling that, you know, whenever a teacher opens my mouth and says something to a student that you must do this.
Yeah.
We're actually just standing in the way.
Mm. Can you remember a time when this happened where you said, I shouldn't have done that, like where there's regrets? I mean, I certainly know if I look back on some of the things that I was involved in, I certainly have them.
Absolutely. Okay, once I start to really consider the non-aggression principle and how it applies to pedagogy, when I'm standing in front of a class and I'm lecturing students, you know, I'm doing what parents and what society expects. But right now, what I've done is I've shifted my classroom. I've created a new department in my private school.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I basically teach design and technology. And so all of the situations now are essentially what the students create. And so it's a very different situation. And the response of my current career path is totally in response to all of those situations. I mean, everything that I've done, all of the stuff that I've created up to this point has been pretty much me telling the student what they need to know, what they need to do, and laying out the guideline according to the Prussian education model, because that's what people expect. And that's what was expected of me.
Sure. I don't think that anyone really can walk away with the feeling or the belief that their mind is competent in any way. So something you said that I really identified with is whenever you make or have one of these directives that you're getting in their way, I mean, the whole process is just about getting in their way over and over and over again until it's so normalized. I can really only speak from my experience as a student or as a teacher, but I know for me as a student, when I left school, I did not have, you know, any confidence in the competency of my own mind. Maybe it was worse for me than some people. I'd just like to hear from the guys in the room with me feelings on that, graduating from school. Now, you, Osborne, didn't have like a traditional school experience, right?
I homeschooled a lot, and I went to 2 years of high school at the end of that.
Did you feel that had any negative impact on you, or did you feel that?
Yeah, I think it sucked a lot of my brain out.
Even just in 2 years, like at the end when you...
Yeah, you get really cynical about life, and you transition from situation where you're learning to a situation where you're playing the game.
Yeah.
And really the only thing you're learning is how to play the game rather than learning anything about life.
Sure. And I think that even that has a unique insight, like what you're describing, that I think a lot of people don't have, that, oh, I'm playing a game. You know, I think for a lot of people, there's a lot more at stake. And they can't see it in this, like, well, I can detach myself from this and understand the silliness of this. Yeah, I got a call today from a mother who wants me to tutor her son, who's in 10th grade, for a quarter final, you know, for one quarter, for one class called American Studies. And the final is going to be on the purpose of government. So I said, yes, I will do it. I will help. And I'm going to have to be careful about how I do that because the job, the contract that I'm making with the mother is to help him get a good grade on the final, not to teach him about how what he's probably learning is bullshit. But, you know, she says he's freaking out. He's having a nervous breakdown because it's a test. There's a test that he's allowed to retake. He got an 80 on it, which at his school is like a C-. And just like the temptation to say to somebody like that, this doesn't matter. You know, this is not the real world. I said this on a show a long time ago about a kid who committed suicide because of bullying. Kid I was supposed to tutor, right? And I met and I had an initial meeting with him. And then like 3-4 days later, I found out he was dead. He hung himself. And I talked about this in an episode of the show, maybe like 130 episodes ago. It was during the Kids Are Not Defective series. That becomes magnified into everything. So the fact that you, I think maybe Osborne having, I mean, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but having the foundation of like, you know, having that trust that your own mind is sound and competent, that then when you get to that place, this is a game that I have to play with these silly people who think that this is important. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that never occurred to me. I mean, I thought that was it. That was, it seemed like everything there was in the world. How about you, Corey?
Well, I remember getting towards the end of high school and certainly after I finished high school, looking back on it and just thinking about how little of value I had actually learned.
Yeah.
And then thinking surely college will be better, but it was so much worse. And then getting out into the world after I, like, you know, decided to take a break from college because I didn't really get what it was going to do for me. And then getting out in the world and, like, feeling like I just didn't know anything of value that I could do with my life.
Yeah.
You know, and I just, I became very cynical, you know, while I was in high school, of, like, looking around at all the stuff I was being made to do and going, this is all ridiculous.
I remember being horrified to graduate from college because you play that game for so long and you get really good at playing the game and there's nothing out in the real world that is similar to that. So you don't know what in the world to do with yourself.
Well, you could,
other than go to grad school.
You could, be a research fellow.
Right.
At some,
but even
play your cards right. You never have to leave college. You just go right into becoming an associate professor and then become a professor and,
so there's another link on there that's worth watching. It's by an educational researcher named Sugata Mitra, and it's a TED Talk where he talks about the same things, the same sort of outcomes for children, which I found very interesting, because, you know, it's very worthwhile watch. It's about, and I know a lot of TED Talks, they tend to worship the state and all this other stuff, but this one's different. This one will definitely, when I've shown it to my colleagues, my teacher colleagues, it's either people start screaming or it's absolute silence because it challenges the entire paradigm of teachers. When I first saw it, I felt like the kind of education that I've been involved with was like looking at the comet as it was extincting all the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous. It's on its way out. And what it makes me think of is that we need to start thinking about a different business model of education that's going to outcompete what's going on now. And here's my thought, and this is why I called in, is that when it comes to all the technology and all the other things and the whole Prussian model of education, maybe it's not activism that's going to kill it. Maybe it's going to be technology. And maybe if teachers want to have any kind of job in the future at all, the only thing that they can cultivate with students is their relationship.
Don't you think technology is already on its way to doing away with the Prussian model of education? Just because
it is, but not, it's not reflected in the public schools, not at all. I mean, the more that technology creeps into the public school, the more they clamp down.
Oh, sure.
And the thing is, it's not, and they make all kinds of excuses for it. You know, we don't want people to text each other and sell drugs. We don't want this and we don't want that. But when they start talking about cheating, that's when they're starting to get closer to the truth.
Yeah.
And that the whole idea of what they're trying to measure is a false benchmark. It's something that is put up there that has no meaning whatsoever. I mean, if you can look it up on the internet and get all the answers, there's not a lot of real value that you can get out of that. It's basically like if I can go to a library and get the same information, there's not a lot of purpose for that class. And that's what this article and the video that I linked really talk about, is that children are able to teach themselves complex knowledge. And that Sugata Mitra TED Talk, they provide evidence. They start talking about a study where the children are able to teach themselves advanced biotechnology concepts on their own. Okay? So even for that, you don't need a teacher.
Right. And
so that's it. All we have are the relationships. That's what we can provide for students. And that's what teachers are missing. You know, when they're mean to students, when they don't sit down and talk to them as humans, when we get into this authoritarian mindset, that's what we're missing. And that's why I think the schools, the real schools of the future, if we can get a business model surrounding this, is going to be based off of a pedagogy that has some kind of link to the non-aggression principle.
Well, it was certainly what I missed, John, because, you know, I went to college and had this professor. I mean, I've told this story a bunch of times, but, you know, I went into teaching history in 2004 as if I have this whole fresh perspective that you kids are going to be so privileged to be exposed to. Mm. And I ceremoniously put all of the textbooks in the closet on the first day of school and said, we're not following the standards, you know, and I have my own curriculum and it's going to be exciting. And I'm going to tell you the truth about Columbus and all of this stuff. But it was largely ineffectual because all of the things that are really important about, you know, what you're saying with the relationship between a mentor and somebody who needs to learn, or more importantly, wants to learn, has a desire and intrinsic motivation to learn something on their own, that didn't exist. So I was still stuck in that, you know, the Prussian model, the authoritarian paradigm. And because of that, for the 2 years that I taught, even though I thought I had all of this interesting material, I ultimately failed as a teacher because I didn't understand exactly what you're saying.
All of that stuff, when I trained to become a teacher, all of that stuff ended pretty much on the second day of my teaching career. I taught at an alternative school for adjudicated youth, and all of my students had been shit on by the system unbelievably. And what I realized with teaching these guys is that the only thing that mattered to them was to have a relationship with a caring adult. You know, it even came down to, you know, I handed out like one little piece of paper that you give out when a student disobeys the rules and all this other stuff. They give you a piece of paper. One of my students took it outside, ripped it up and pissed on it, and then handed it back to me.
Yeah.
And I realized how little power that I actually had, that the power that I thought I had was a complete illusion.
Yeah, I mean, I have very similar experiences. In fact, I know you called into the show before a few months ago, and I said, our stories were so similar. That was where my career began, in a school like that. And it was interesting that when I had taught at, hey, do you have headphones?
I do not. Sorry.
Is it possible for you to turn me down and still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll try to go forward with that. The school that I worked at before was much more intense. And I think I realized a lot of those things when I was working there. The campus that I ran was for kids who had what was called sexually reactive behavior issues. So they were treated like robots because they were taught that they were a threat to themselves and everyone around them all the time. And they would have these programmed responses, like if there was something even mildly inappropriate on television, they would say, change the channel, change the channel. They would all just start chanting, change the channel, we can't watch this, we can't watch this. If a staff turned their back or walked out of the room where they were not supervised for more than 30 seconds, this chorus would begin of unsafe, 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 unsafe. It was horrifying. And I worked very hard with the psychologist who was also running the clinical side of that program to say, if these kids are going back into society, the way this program works has to change. And I think I learned a lot prior to teaching history, working at this other school. I think I learned a lot about the things that you were saying there. But then when I went to this other school where there were not those kinds of behavior problems, yeah, the kids had been adjudicated. They had failed in public schools. They didn't fit in. And those were the kids that I liked. But these were kids who were in this less intensive, less hands-on type of school, not so heavily medicated. They were kids who would sit in class and learn. And I had these very, very high expectations for what I would be able to accomplish there. And I think I wound up taking out some of my disappointment on them because I was just another asshole at the front of the room, even though I had all of these exciting ideas and different approaches, because I prioritized pedagogy over relationships, because I went to this new school with different expectations than I had at the old school. I ultimately failed. I got an email from one or two kids, like, or a Facebook message from one or two kids saying, you were a good teacher, I'm glad I had you. But it could have been so much more productive. I could have accomplished so much more if I had taken, I think, the lessons that you're talking about here and the lessons that I had learned at this other school and applied them consistently. That, yes, you need to be treated like human beings. Relationships are more important than any kind of top-down authoritarian Prussian pedagogy. No matter how interesting the material is, that does not work. And when I wrote about, when I was in grad school and wrote A Philosophy for Education, it was exactly that sage on the stage kind of philosophy. The teaching should be top-down, and the person should be entertaining and engaging, and they should control the class.
You know, when it comes to changing the paradigm of education, the technology ultimately, I think, is what's going to be that's going to be the ultimate factor that does it, because right now it's making teachers obsolete. And when you look at those articles and when you look at the examples, the kinds of ways that we teach now, the kinds of ways that's demanded by the public education system are completely they're completely taken over by the different apps. I mean, when a student can go on to an iPad and they're working 47 different apps, and they can find a different app to teach them the different kinds of things that they want to learn. And if they can't work if it doesn't work for them, they can just delete the app. You know what? You can't delete a bad teacher, but you can delete an app.
Right.
You know?
Oh, sure.
So that's the thing, is that you automatically can start to find the different kinds of ways that will teach you the best.
Yeah, I think that's great stuff. And I'll package this up, John, as a separate show, and I'll read that article at the beginning and put this conversation and that article out as a podcast. I appreciate your input, just as before. Anything else before we let you go?
I guess the thing that I wanted to leave off on was that we need to start thinking about business models for education for the future of the whole profession. I mean, if you're a teacher, it's really your survival is about trying to not only being able to develop relationships, but finding ways to utilize the technology to teach children. Because the kids that are coming up that are going to utilize this technology first, those are the ones who are going to really have an advantage over everybody else. The Prussian education system doesn't work. And this system seems to go far beyond what's ever been even thought possible from any kind of teacher. I mean, when you have students who are teaching themselves English in 2 weeks and they know enough language now to hack the Android system, okay, or you have students in 3 months, as in the other video that I referenced, where they're able to learn advanced biotechnology, genetic concepts, and you know what, they don't even have a teacher at the front of the room, where everybody's able to teach themselves, and you have learning communities that are forming spontaneously. I mean, this is a completely different, this is a sea change in the type of education that's possible.
Yeah, go ahead.
So this is the kind of things that I'm studying. This is what my wife and I are working on, is these kinds of models. Both of us are doctoral students in education, and I'm really stoked about this, because this is the future. It's not people standing up in front of the class. It is a bunch of small community-based students getting together in entrepreneurial groups, okay, with real business models, where teachers feel like they can make money and they can actually be successful, outside of the system. That's what's coming.
Yeah. And just to reiterate the difference in between education and schooling, and this example that we started this conversation talking about with is the real authentic definition for me of education. You said the Prussian system doesn't work. Well, it's worked for a lot of things. Educating people was not one of them. Millions with their own desires and needs and goals for their lives, with leaving families behind, have put on costumes and marched into bullets, right? So it works for some people very well for certain things, right? But self-esteem, education, self-actualization, those have never been on the list. So I think that making that distinction, making it continuously, articulating the difference between schooling and education is very, very important. And, the approach has always been for me, let's not talk about it in terms of does it work or not. And this was actually the show we did last week with Mark Edge and Ian Freeman from Free Talk Live. Like, does something work or not is one way to have the conversation, and we can employ all different opposing statistics and studies, and that might not get anywhere, because if you try to talk to a public school teacher that about education schooling, public schooling not working, they have heartwarming stories about one experience or another, and then of course they commit the fallacy of composition and apply it to everyone who attends public school, which is obviously false, when the net impact of this Prussian system has been a huge negative in the world going back 150 years.
And if you're having that conversation, it's almost guaranteed that you're working from two basically different definitions of what it means for that to work. Like, very much
when
like
I
the conversation
define,
we had
when
last
I define
week.
Work, what I'm specifically thinking about is something that can be assessed that's not assessed right now. And so the assessment system that we're dealing with when it comes to the public schools is an assessment system that's really assessing your adherence to the behaviors that are beneficial to the state. And in that sense, the Prussian model works great.
Okay.
However, when we start to talk about the kinds of behaviors and the kinds of things that we want, that an individual that I would want my children to exhibit, that's something very different than those kinds of behaviors. I mean, I always see, here's the classic poster that's up in everybody's classroom in every school I've ever seen. it's, well, that's a little bit of hyperbole, but it's out there. So you have a school of fish swimming one way, and then you have one fish swimming against the current, right? And it's always some kind of tagline, dare to be different, or whatever they say. That kind of behavior is not going to be assessed. It's not going to be valued at all.
It's funny.
In a public school system.
Everything so, but that poster inside that environment contradicts that message.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And so what we're really dealing with is kind of coming up with an assessment system that captures real value. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
But what is real value when it comes to students? What is real to all of them, to all of us, to what would I want for my children in a school system? And so that's the assessment system. That's the real benchmark. And so whenever we talk about any kind of educational statistics, they're always talking about what other people want for you. And it goes back to my comment. Whenever the teacher opens their mouth, they're standing in the way.
I agree. I am also somewhat reluctant about the word system. Like when you're talking about an education system, I think that's as foreign to me as somebody proposing like a what should we have for dinner system. I don't know if systems are possible in this respect. So I would be surprised, and I'd like to talk about this more in the future, but it would be hard for me to believe that there's a set of uniform qualities that would be desirable for all. Certainly there's a few, right? Certainly we could make a list, but how that could be implemented in a system, I'm not sure.
There's not a set of uniform qualities that's desirable for all. Not at all.
Sure.
I mean, when I say a system, it's an organic system where people and parents and children have the ability to go out and find their own kind of mentors, their own kind of people within the community that are willing to teach them. I mean, when I think of a business model for education, if you can imagine having a small group of children where you invite some older people who have real experience in the community to come in and talk, and they all have independent learning communities without grade levels, without all the sacred cows that we have all in our schooling system right now, that would be one type of school. But you could have all kinds of different schools out there. It's all dependent on the choice. And so when I say system, what I really mean is an organic system where people are free to choose what they want.
Right. That I totally agree with. I appreciate the call, John. I will read the article and I will include it in the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good night. Look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
So you know what's happened? I think we've just stumbled across a self-organizing system. A self-organizing system is one where a structure appears without explicit intervention from the outside. Self-organizing systems also always show emergence, which is that the system starts to do things which it was never designed for, which is why you react the way you do, because it looks impossible. I think I can make a guess now. Education is a self-organizing system where learning is an emergent phenomenon. It'll take a few years to prove it experimentally, but I'm going to try.
In a closing note, many of you might have been curious about the title of today's show, Catalaxy. This was an idea first introduced by Ludwig von Mises, and the term was coined either by Friedrich Hayek or Richard Whately. Hayek used the term because he was not completely satisfied with the word economy. If you look at the etymology, the Greek origin of economy, it means the art of household management. And, of course, the market is far more expansive than one household. So Hayek's definition was the order brought about by the mutual adjustment of many individual economies in a market. It came also from the Greek katalasso, which had a few meanings, to exchange, but also to admit in the community and to make friends. Hayek was using it to describe a self-organizing system of voluntary cooperation, the invisible hand or the spontaneous order of the free market. In theory, a self-organizing system, as well as the emergent properties of a market economy, the division of labor, prices, economic growth, etc. Other examples, the Underground Railroad and the Internet, also known as the place where many of us learned almost everything we know. Thanks for listening and take care.